Well, then, here you are, father and son,
Pop said, giving them an admiring grandfatherly smile. His eyes twinkled behind a haze of pipe smoke, and for a moment, although he was clean-shaven, Kevin thought Pop looked like Father Christmas.
You've got a fine boy, Mr. Delavan, fine.
I know, Mr. Delavan said. I was upset when I heard he'd been dealing with you because I want him to stay that way.
That's hard,
Pop said with the faintest touch of reproach.
That's hard coming from a man who, when he had nowhere else to turn...
That's over, Mr. Delavan said.
There, that's just what I mean to say.
But this isn't.
It will be,
Pop said. He held a hand out to Kevin, and Kevin gave him the sun camera.
It will be today.
He held the camera up, turning it over in his hands.
This is a piece of work. What kind of piece? I don't know. But your boy wants to smash it because he thinks it's dangerous. I think he's right. But I told him, you don't want your daddy to think you're a sissy, do you? That's the only reason I had him hoe you down here, John.
I liked Mr. Delavan better.
All right, Pop said and sighed. I can see you ain't gonna warm up none and let bygones be bygones.
No. Kevin looked from one man to the other, his face distressed.
Well, it don't matter,
Pop said. Both his voice and face went cold with remarkable suddenness, and he didn't look like Father Christmas at all.
When I said the past is past and what's done is done, I meant it. Except when it affects what people do in the here and now. But I'm going to say this, Mr. Delavan. I don't bottom deal, and you know it.
Pop delivered this magnificent lie with such flat coldness that both of them believed it. Mr. Delavan even felt a little ashamed of himself, as incredible as that was.
Our business was our business. You told me what you wanted. I told you what I'd have to have in return. And you give it to me, and there was an end to it. This is another thing.
And then Pop told a lie even more magnificent, a lie which was simply too towering to be disbelieved.
I got no stake in this, Mr. Delavan. There is nothing I want but to help your boy. I like him.
He smiled, and Father Christmas was back so fast and strong that Kevin forgot he had ever been gone. Yet more than this, John Delavan, who had for months worked himself to the edge of exhaustion, and perhaps even death between the rollers in order to pay the exorbitant price this man demanded to atone for a momentary lapse into insanity, John Delavan forgot that other expression, too. Pop led them along the twisting aisles, through the smell of dead newsprint, and past the tick-tock clocks, and he put the Sun 660 casually down on the work table, a little too near the edge. Just as Kevin had done in his own house after taking that first picture. And then, just went on toward the stairs at the back which led up to his little apartment. There was a dusty old mirror propped against the wall back there, and Pop looked into it, watching to see if the boy or his father would pick the camera up, or move it further away from the edge. He didn't think either would, but it was possible. They spared it not so much as a passing glance. And as Pop led them up the narrow stairway with the ancient, eroded rubber treads, he grinned in a way it would have been bad business for anyone to see, and thought,
"Damn, I'm good."
He opened the door, and they went into the apartment. Neither John nor Kevin Delavan had ever been in Pop's private quarters, and John knew of no one who had. In a way, this was not surprising. No one was ever going to nominate Pop as the town's number one citizen. John thought it was not impossible that the old fuck had a friend or two. The world never exhausted its oddities, it seemed, but if so, he didn't know who they were. And Kevin spared a fleeting thought for Mr. Baker, his favorite teacher. He wondered if, perchance, Mr. Baker had ever gotten into the sort of crack he'd need a fellow like Pop to get him out of. This seemed as unlikely to him as the idea of Pop having friends seemed to his father. But then... an hour ago, the idea that his own father... well, it was best let go, perhaps. Pop did have a friend, or at least an acquaintance, or two, but he didn't bring them here. He didn't want to. It was his place, and it came closer to revealing his true nature than he wanted anyone to see. It struggled to be neat and couldn't get there. The wallpaper was marked with water stains. They weren't glaring, but stealthy and brown, like the phantom thoughts that trouble anxious minds. There were crusty dishes in the old-fashioned deep sink, and although the table was clean and the lid on the plastic waste can was shut, there was an odor of sardines and something else, unwashed feet maybe, which was almost not there, an odor as stealthy as the water stains on the wallpaper. The living room was tiny. Here the smell was not of sardines and, maybe, feet, but of old pipe smoke. Two windows looked out on nothing more scenic than the alley that ran behind Mulberry Street, and while their panes showed some signs of having been washed, at least swiped at occasionally, the corners were bleared and greasy, with years of condensed smoke. The whole place had an air of nasty things swept under the faded hooked rugs and hidden beneath the old-fashioned, overstuffed easy chair and sofa. Both of these articles were light green, and your eye wanted to tell you they matched, but couldn't, because they didn't. Not quite. The only new things in the room were a large Mitsubishi television with a 25-inch screen and a VCR on the end table beside it. To the left of the end table was a rack which caught Kevin's eye because it was totally empty. Pop had thought it best to put the better than 70 fuck movies he owned in the closet for the time being. One video cassette rested on top of the television in an unmarked case.
"Sit down,"
Pop said, gesturing at the lumpy couch. He went over to the TV and slipped the cassette out of its case. Mr. Delavan looked at the couch with a momentary expression of doubt, as if he thought it might have bugs, and then sat down gingerly. Kevin sat beside him. The fear was back, stronger than ever. Pop turned on the VCR, slid the cassette in, and then pushed the carriage down.
"I know a fellow up the city," he began.
To residents of Castle Rock and its neighboring towns, up the city always meant Lewiston.
"Who's run a camera store for 20 years or so. He got into this VCR business as soon as it started up. Said it was going to be the wave of the future. He wanted me to go halves with him, but I thought he was nuts. Well, I was wrong on that one, is what I mean to say, but..."
"Get to the point," Kevin's father said.
"I'm trying,"
Pop said, wide-eyed and injured.
"If you'll let me."
Kevin pushed his elbow gently against his father's side, and Mr. Delavan said no more.
"Anyway, a couple of years ago, he found out renting tapes for folks to watch wasn't the only way to make money with these gadgets. If you was willing to lay out as little as $800, you could take people's movies and snapshots and put them on a tape for them. Lots easier to watch."
Kevin made a little involuntary noise, and Pop smiled and nodded.
"Yeah, you took 58 pictures with that camera of yours, and we all saw each one was a little different than the last one. And I guess we knew what it meant, but I wanted to see for myself. You don't have to be from Missouri to say, 'Show me,' is what I mean to say."
"You tried to make a movie out of those snapshots?" Mr. Delavan asked.
"Didn't try," Pop said. "Did. Or rather, the feller I know up the city did, but it was my idea."
"Is it a movie?" Kevin asked. He understood what Pop had done, and part of him was even chagrined that he hadn't thought of it himself. But mostly, he was awash in wonder and delight at the idea.
"Look for yourself,"
Pop said, and turned on the TV.
58 pictures. When this fella does snapshots for folks, he generally videotapes each one for 5 seconds. Long enough to get a good look, he says, but not long enough to get bored before you go on to the next one. I told him I wanted each of these on for just a single second, and to run them right together with no fades."
Kevin remembered a game he used to play in grade school when he had finished some lesson and had free time before the next one began. He had a little dime pad of paper, which was called a rainbow school pad, because there would be 30 pages of little yellow sheets, then 30 pages of little pink sheets, then 30 pages of green, and so on. To play the game, you went to the very last page, and at the bottom you drew a stick man wearing baggy shorts and holding his arms out. On the next page, you drew the same stick man in the same place and wearing the same baggy shorts, only this time you drew his arms further up, but just a little bit. You did that on every page until the arms came together over the stick man's head. Then, if you still had time, You went on drawing the stick man, but now with the arms going down. And if you flipped the pages very fast when you were done, you had a crude sort of cartoon which showed a boxer celebrating a KO. He raised his hands over his head, clasped them, shook them, lowered them. He shivered. His father looked at him. Kevin shook his head and murmured, "Nothing."
"So what I mean to say is the tape only runs about a minute," Pop said. "You got to look close. Ready?"
"No," Kevin thought.
"I guess so,"
Mr. Delavan said. He was still trying to sound grumpy and put out, but Kevin could tell he had gotten interested in spite of himself.
"Okay,"
Pop Merrill said, and pushed the play button. Kevin told himself over and over again that it was stupid to feel scared. He told himself this, and it didn't do a single bit of good. He knew what he was going to see, because he and Meg had both noticed the sun was doing something besides simply reproducing the same image over and over, like a photocopier. It did not take long for them to realize that the photographs were expressing movement from one to the next.
"Look," Meg had said. "The dog's moving."
Instead of responding with one of the friendly but irritating wisecracks he usually reserved for his little sister, Kevin had said,
"It does look like it, but you can't tell for sure, Meg."
"Yes, you can,"
she said. They were in his room, where he had been morosely looking at the camera. It sat on the middle of his desk with his new schoolbooks, which he had been meaning to cover, pushed to one side. Meg had bent the gooseneck of his study lamp so it shone a bright circle of light on the middle of his desk blotter. She moved the camera aside and put the first picture, the one with the dab of cake frosting on it, in the center of the light.
"Count the fence posts between the dogs behind and the right-hand edge of the picture," she said.
"Those are pickets, not fence posts," he told her,
"like what you do when your nose goes on strike."
"Ha ha, count them." He did. He could see four and part of a fifth, although the dog's scraggly hindquarters obscured most of that one.
"Now look at this one."
She put the fourth Polaroid in front of him. Now he could see all of the fifth picket and part of a sixth. So he knew, or believed, he was going to see a cross between a very old cartoon and one of those flipbooks he used to make in grammar school when the time weighed heavy on his hands. The last 25 seconds of the tape were indeed like that, although, Kevin thought, the flipbooks he had drawn in the second grade were really better, the perceived action of the boxer raising and lowering his hands smoother. In the last 25 seconds of the videotape, the action moved in rams and jerks, which made the old Keystone Cop silent films look like marbles of modern filmmaking in comparison. Still, the key word was action, and it held all of them, even Pop, spellbound. They watched the minute of footage three times without saying a word. There was no sound but breathing. Kevin's fast and smooth, through his nose, his father's deeper, Pop's a phlegmy rattle in his narrow chest. And the first 30 seconds or so. He had expected action, he supposed. There was action in the flipbooks, and there was action in the Saturday morning cartoons, which were just a slightly more sophisticated version of the flipbooks. But what he had not expected was that for the first 30 seconds of the tape, it wasn't like watching notebook pages rapidly thumbed, or even a primitive cartoon like Possible Possum on TV. For 30 seconds, 28 anyway, his single Polaroid photographs looked eerily like a real movie. Not a Hollywood movie, of course, not even a low-budget horror movie of the sort Megan sometimes pestered him to rent for their own VCR when their mother and father went out for the evening. It was more like a snippet of home movie made by someone who has just gotten an 8mm camera and doesn't know how to use it very well yet. In those first 28 seconds, the black, no-breed dog walked with barely perceptible jerks along the fence, exposing 5, 6, 7 pickets. It even paused to sniff a second time at one of them, apparently reading another one of those canine telegrams. Then it walked on, head down and toward the fence, hindquarters switched out toward the camera. And halfway through this first part, Kevin noted something else he hadn't seen before. The photographer had apparently swung his camera to keep the dog in the frame. If he, or she, hadn't done so, the dog would have simply walked out of the picture, leaving nothing to look at but the fence. The pickets at the far right of the first two or three photographs disappeared behind the right-hand border of the picture, and new pickets appeared at the left. You could tell because the tip of one of those two rightmost pickets had been broken off. Now it was no longer in the frame. The dog started to sniff again. Then its head came up. Its good ear stiffened. The one which had been slashed and laid limp in some long-ago fight tried to do the same. There was no sound. But Kevin felt with a certainty beyond repudiation that the dog had begun to growl. The dog had sensed something or someone. What or who? Kevin looked at the shadow they had first dismissed as the branch of a tree or maybe a phone pole, and knew. Its head began to turn. And that was when the second half of this strange film began. 30 seconds of snap-jerk action that made your head ache and your eyeballs hot. Pop had had a hunch, Kevin thought. Or maybe he had even read about something like this before. Either way, it had proved out and was too obvious to need stating. With the pictures taken quite closely together, if not exactly one after the other, the action in the makeshift movie almost flowed. Not quite, but almost. But when the time between the photographs was spaced, what they were watching became something that nauseated your eye because it wanted to see either a moving picture or a series of still photographs, and instead, it saw both and neither. Time was passing in that flat Polaroid world. Not at the same speed it passed in this real one, or the sun would have come up or gone down over there 3 times already. And whatever the dog was going to do would be done if it had something to do. And if it did not, it would just be gone. And there would be only the moveless, seemingly eternal, eroded picket fence guarding the listless patch of lawn. But it was passing. The dog's head was coming around to face the photographer, owner of the shadow, like the head of a dog in the grip of a fit. At one moment, the face and even the shape of the head was obscured by that floppy ear. Then you saw one black brown eye enclosed by a round and somehow mucky corona that made Kevin think of a spoiled egg white. Then you saw half the muzzle, with the lips appearing slightly wrinkled, as if the dog were getting ready to bark or growl. And last of all, you saw 3/4 of a face, somehow more awful than the face of any mere dog had a right to be, even a mean one. The white speckles along its muzzle suggested it was no longer young. At the very end of the tape, you saw the dog's lips were indeed pulling back. There was only one blink of white. Kevin thought it was a tooth. He didn't see that until the 3rd run-through. It was the eye that held it. It was homicidal. This breedless dog almost screamed rogue. And it was nameless. He knew that as well. He knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that no Polaroid man or Polaroid woman or Polaroid child had ever named that Polaroid dog. It was a stray, born stray, raised stray, grown old and mean stray, the avatar of all the dogs who had ever wandered the world, unnamed and unhomed, killing chickens, eating garbage out of the cans they had long since learned to knock over, sleeping in culverts and beneath the porches of deserted houses. Its wits would be dim, but its instincts would be sharp and red. It... When Pop Merrill spoke, Kevin was so deeply and fundamentally startled out of his thoughts that he nearly screamed.
"The man who took those pictures," he said, "if there was a person, is what I mean to say, what do you suppose happened to him?"
Pop had frozen the last frame with his remote control. A line of static ran through the picture. Kevin wished it ran through the dog's eye, but the line was below it. That eye stared out at them, baleful, stupidly murderous. No, not stupidly, not entirely. That was what made it not merely frightening, but terrifying. And no one needed to answer Pop's question. You needed no more pictures to understand what was going to happen next. The dog had perhaps heard something. Of course it had. And Kevin knew what. It had heard that squidgy little whine. Further pictures would show it continuing to turn, and then beginning to fill more and more of each frame, until there was nothing to see but dog. No listless, patchy lawn, No fence, no sidewalk, no shadow. Just the dog. Who meant to attack? Who meant to kill if it could? Kevin's dry voice seemed to be coming from someone else. I don't think it likes getting its picture taken, he said. Pop's short laugh was like a bunch of dry twigs broken over a knee for kindling.
Rewind it, Mr. Delman said.
You want to see the whole thing again?
Pop asked.
No, just the last 10 seconds or so.
Pop used the remote control to go back, then ran it again. The dog turned its head, as jerky as a robot which is old and running down but still dangerous. And Kevin wanted to tell them, stop now, just stop, that's enough, just stop, and let's break the camera. Because there was something else, wasn't there? Something he didn't want to think about, but soon would. Like it or not, he could feel it breaching in his mind, like the broad back of a whale.
Once more, Mr. Delavan said. Frame by frame, this time. Can you do that?
Yeah, Pop said. Goddamn machine does everything but the laundry.
This time, one frame, one picture at a time. It was not like a robot now. Or not exactly, but like some weird clock. Something that belonged with Pop's other specimens downstairs. Jerk, jerk, jerk. The head coming around. Soon they would be faced by that merciless, not quite idiotic eye again.
What's that? Mr. Delavan asked.
What's what?
Pop asked, as if he didn't know it was the thing the boy hadn't wanted to talk about the other day, the thing, he was convinced, that made up the boy's mind about destroying the camera once and for all.
Underneath his neck, Mr. Delavan said, and pointed. It's not wearing a collar or a tag, but it's got something around its neck on a string or thin rope.
I don't know, Pop said imperturbably. Maybe a boy does. Young folks have sharper eyes than us old fellas.
Mr. Delavan turned to look at Kevin. Can you make it out? He fell silent. It's really small. His mind returned to what his father had said when they were leaving the house. If she never asks you, you never have to tell her. That's just the way we do things in the grown-up world. Just now, he had asked Kevin if he could make out what that thing under the dog's neck was. Kevin hadn't really answered that question. He had said something else altogether. It's really small. And it was. The fact that he knew what it was, in spite of that, well, what had his father called it, skating up to the edge of a lie? And he couldn't actually see it, not actually, just the same he knew. The eye only suggested. The heart understood. Just as his heart understood that, if he was right, the camera must be destroyed. Must be. At that moment, Pop Merrill was suddenly struck by an agreeable inspiration. He got up and snapped off the TV.
I've got the pictures downstairs, he said. Brought them back with the videotape. I seen that thing myself, and ran my magnifying glass over it, but still couldn't tell. But it does look familiar. God cuss it. Just let me go get the pictures in the glass.
We might as well go down with you, Kevin said. Which was the last thing in the world Pop wanted. But then Delavan stepped in, God bless him, and said he might like to look at the tape again after they looked at the last couple of pictures under the magnifying glass.
Won't take a minute,
Pop said, and was gone, sprightly as a bird hopping from twig to twig on an apple tree, before either of them could have protested, if either had had a mind to. Kevin did not. That thought had finally breached its monstrous back in his mind, and like it or not, he was forced to contemplate it. It was simple, as a whale's back is simple, at least to the eye of one who does not study whales for a living, and it was colossal in the same way. It wasn't an idea, but a simple certainty. It had to do with that odd flatness Polaroids always seemed to have, with the way they showed you things only in two dimensions. Although all photographs did that, it was that other photographs seemed to at least suggest a third dimension, even those taken with a simple Kodak 110. The things in his photographs which showed things he had never seen through the sun's viewfinder, or anywhere else for that matter, were that same way, flatly, unapologetically two-dimensional, except for the dog. The dog wasn't flat. The dog wasn't meaningless, a thing you could recognize, but which had no emotional impact. The dog not only seemed to suggest three dimensions, but to really have them. The way a hologram seems to really have them. Or one of those 3D movies where you had to wear special glasses to reconcile the double images. It's not a Polaroid dog, Kevin thought. And it doesn't belong in the world Polaroids take pictures of. That's crazy, I know it is. But I also know it's true. So what does it mean? Why is my camera taking pictures of it over and over? And what Polaroid man or Polaroid woman is snapping pictures of it? Does he or she even see it? If it is a three-dimensional dog in a two-dimensional world, maybe he or she doesn't see it, can't see it. They say for us time is the fourth dimension, and we know it's there, but we can't see it. We can't even really feel it pass, although sometimes, especially when we're bored, I guess it seems like we can. But when you got right down to it, all that might not even matter. And the questions were far too tough for him anyway. There were other questions that seemed more important to him. Vital questions. Maybe even mortal ones. Like, why was the dog in his camera? Did it want something of him, or just anybody? At first, he had thought the answer was anybody. Anybody would do, because anybody could take pictures of it. And the movement always advanced. But the thing around its neck, that thing that wasn't a collar, that had to do with him, Kevin Delavan, and nobody else. Did it want to do something to him? If the answer to that question was yes, you could forget all the other ones, because it was pretty goddamn obvious what the dog wanted to do. It was in its murky eye, in the snarl you could just see beginning. He thought it wanted two things. First, to escape. Then, to kill. There's a man or woman over there with a camera who maybe doesn't even see that dog, Kevin thought. And if the photographer can't see the dog, maybe the dog can't see the photographer, and so the photographer is safe. But if the dog really is three-dimensional, maybe he sees out. Maybe he sees whoever is using my camera. Maybe it's still not me, or not specifically me. Maybe whoever is using the camera is its target. Still, the thing it was wearing around its neck, what about that? He thought of the cur's dark eyes, saved from stupidity by the single, malevolent spark. God knew how the dog had gotten into that Polaroid world in the first place, but when its picture was taken, it could see out, and it wanted to get out. And Kevin believed in his heart that it wanted to kill him first. The thing it was wearing around its neck said it wanted to kill him first, proclaimed that it wanted to kill him first. But after that, why, after Kevin, anyone would do. Anyone at all. In a way, it was like another game you played when you were a little kid, wasn't it? It was like Giant Step. The dog had been walking along the fence. The dog had heard the Polaroid. That squidgy little whine. It turned and saw what? Its own world or universe? A world or universe enough like its own so it saw or sensed it could or at least might be able to live and hunt here? It didn't matter. Now, every time someone took a picture of it, the dog would get closer. It would get closer and closer until, well, until what? Until it burst through somehow? That's stupid, he muttered. It'd never fit. What? His father asked, roused from his own musings. Nothing, Kevin said. I was just thinking to myself. Then, from downstairs, muffled but audible, they heard Pop Merrill cry out in mingled dismay, irritation, and surprise.
Well, ship fire and save matches, goddammit!
Kevin and his father looked at each other, startled. Let's go see what happened, his father said, and got up. I hope he didn't fall down and break his arm or something. I mean, part of me does hope it, you know. Kevin thought, what if he's been taking pictures? What if that dog's down there? It hadn't sounded like fear in the old man's voice, and of course there really was no way a dog that looked as big as a medium-sized German shepherd could come through either a camera the size of the Sun's 660 or one of the prints it made. You might as well try to drag a washing machine through a knothole. Still, he felt fear enough for both of them, for all three of them, as he followed his father back down the stairs to the gloomy bazaar below. Going down the stairs, Pop Merrill was as happy as a clam at high tide. He had been prepared to make the switch right in front of them if he had to. Might have been a problem if it had just been the boy, who was still a year or so away from thinking he knew everything. But the boy's dad? Ah, fooling that fine fellow would have been like stealing a bottle from a baby. Had he told the boy about the jam he'd gotten into that time? From the way the boy looked at him, a new, cautious way, Pop thought Delvin probably had. And what else had the father told the son? Well, let's see. Does he let you call him Pop? That means he's planning to pull a fast one on you. That was for starters. He's a low-down snake in the grass, son. That was for seconds. And, of course, there was the prize of them all. Let me do the talking, boy. I know him better than you do. You just let me handle everything. Men like Delavan were to Pop Merrill what a nice platter of fried chicken was to some folks. Tender, tasty, juicy, and all but falling off the bone. Once Delavan had been little more than a kid himself, and he would never fully understand that it wasn't Pop who had stuck his tit in the ringer, but he himself. The man could have gone to his wife, and she would have tapped that old biddy aunt of hers whose tight little ass was lined with $100 bills, and Delavan would have spent some time in the doghouse, but she would have let him out in time. He not only hadn't seen it that way, he hadn't seen it at all, and now, for no reason but idiot time, which came and went without any help from anyone, he thought he knew all there was to know about Reginald Marion Merrill, which was just the way Pop liked it. Why, he could have swapped one camera for the other right in front of the man, and Delavan never would have seen a goddamn thing. That was how sure he was that he had old Pop figured out. But this was better. You never, ever asked Lady Luck for a date. She had a way of standing men up just when they needed her the most. But if she showed up on her own, well, it was wise to drop whatever it was you were doing and take her out and wine her and dine her just as lavishly as you could. That was one bitch you always put out for you if you treated her right. So he went quickly to the work table, bent and extracted the Polaroid 660 with the broken lens from the shadows underneath. He put it on the table, fished a key ring from his pocket, with one quick glance over his shoulder to be sure neither of them had decided to come down after all, and selected the small key which opened the locked drawer that formed the entire left side of the table. In this deep drawer were a number of gold Krugerrands, a stamp album in which the least valuable stamp was worth $600 in the latest Scotch stamp catalog, a coin collection worth approximately $19,000, 2 dozen glossy photographs of a bleary-eyed woman having sexual congress with a Shetland pony, and an amount of cash totaling just over $2,000. The cash, which he stowed in a variety of tin cans, was Pop's loan-out money. John Delavan would have recognized the bills. They were all crumpled tens. Pop deposited Kevin's son's 660 in this drawer, locked it, and put his keyring back in his pocket. Then he pushed the camera with the broken lens off the edge of the work table again and cried out, "Well, shit fire and save matches, goddammit!" loud enough for them to hear. Then he arranged his face in the proper expression of dismay and chagrin and waited for them to come running to see what had happened. "Pop!" Kevin cried. "Mr. Merrill, are you okay?"
"Yeah," he said. "Didn't hurt nothing but my goddamn pride. That camera's just bad luck, I guess. I bent over to open the tool drawer, is what I mean to say, and I knocked the fucking thing right off onto the floor. Only I guess it didn't come through so well this time. I don't know if I should say I'm sorry or not. I mean, you was gonna..."
He held the camera apologetically out to Kevin, who took it, looked at the broken lens and shattered plastic of the housing around it.
"No, it's okay," Kevin told him, turning the camera over in his hands. But he did not handle it in the same gingerly, tentative way he had before, as if it might really be constructed not of plastic and glass, but of some sort of explosive. "I meant to bust it up anyhow.
Guess I saved her the trouble."
"I'd feel better," Kevin began.
Well, I feel the same way about mice. Laugh if you want to, but when I catch one in a trap, and it's dead, I beat it with a broom anyway, just to be sure, is what I mean to say."
Kevin smiled faintly, then looked at his father.
He said he's got a chopping block out back, Dad.
Got a pretty good sledge in the shed, too. If ain't nobody took it.
Do you mind, Dad?
It's your camera, Kev, Delavan said. He flicked a distrustful glance at Pop, but it was a glance that said he distrusted Pop on general principles and not for any specific reason. But if it will make you feel any better, I think it's the right decision.
Good, Kevin said. He felt a tremendous weight go off his shoulders. No, it was from his heart that the weight was lifted. With the lens broken, the camera was surely useless. But he wouldn't feel really at ease until he saw it in fragments around Pop's chopping block. He turned it over in his hands, front to back, and back to front, amused and amazed at how much he liked the broken way it looked and felt.
I think I owe you the cost of that camera, Delavan,
Pop said, knowing exactly how the man would respond.
No, Delavan said. Let's smash it and forget this whole crazy thing ever happened.
He paused. I almost forgot. We were going to look at those last few photos under your magnifying glass. I wanted to see if I could make out the thing the dog's wearing. I keep thinking it looks familiar.
We can do that after we get rid of the camera, can't we? Kevin asked. Okay, Dad?
Sure.
And then, Pop said, it might not be such a bad idea to burn the pictures themselves. You could do it right in my stove.
I think that's a great idea, Kevin said. What do you think, Dad?
I think Mrs. Merrill never raised any fools, his father said.
Well,
Pop said, smiling enigmatically from behind folds of rising blue smoke,
there was five of us, you know.
The day had been bright blue when Kevin and his father walked down to the Emporium Glorium, a perfect autumn day. Now it was 4:30. The sky had mostly clouded over, and it looked like it might rain before dark. The first real chill of the fall touched Kevin's hands. It would chap them red if he stayed out long enough, but he had no plans to. His mom would be home in half an hour, and already he wondered what she would say when she saw Dad was with him, and what his dad would say. But that was for later. Kevin set the Sun 660 on the chopping block in the little backyard, and Pop Merrill handed him a sledgehammer. The haft was worn smooth with usage. The head was rusty, as if someone had left it carelessly out in the rain, not once or twice, but many times. Yet it would do the job all right. Kevin had no doubt of that. The Polaroid, its lens broken and most of the housing around it shattered as well, looked fragile and defenseless sitting there on the block's chipped, chunked, and splintered surface, where you expected to see a length of ash or maple waiting to be split in two. Kevin set his hands on the sledgehammer's smooth handle and tightened them.
You're sure, son? Mr. Delavan asked.
Yes.
Okay.
Kevin's father glanced at his own watch. Do it, then. Pop stood to one side, with his pipe clamped between his wretched teeth, hands in his back pockets. He looked shrewdly from the boy to the man, and then back to the boy, but said nothing. Kevin lifted the sledgehammer, and suddenly, surprised by an anger at the camera he hadn't even known he felt, he brought it down with all the force he could muster.
Too hard, he thought. You're going to miss it. Be lucky not to mash your own foot, and there it will sit. Not much more than a piece of hollow plastic a little kid could stomp flat without half trying. And even if you're lucky enough to miss your foot, Pop will look at you. He won't say anything. He won't have to. It'll all be in the way he looks at you. And he thought also, it doesn't matter if I hit it or not. It's magic. Some kind of magic camera. And you can't break it. Even if you hit it dead on the money, the sledge will just bounce off it like bullets off Superman's chest.
But then, there was no more time to think anything, because the sledge connected squarely with the camera. Kevin really had swung much too hard to maintain anything resembling control. But he got lucky, and the sledgehammer didn't just bounce back up, maybe hitting Kevin square between the eyes and killing him, like the final twist in a horror story. The Sun didn't so much shatter as detonate. Black plastic flew everywhere. A long rectangle with a shiny black square at one end, a picture which would never be taken, Kevin supposed, fluttered to the bare ground beside the chopping block and lay there, face down. There was a moment of silence, so complete, they could hear not only the cars on Lower Main Street, but kids playing tag half a block away in the parking lot behind Wardell's Country Store, which had gone bankrupt 2 years before and had stood vacant ever since.
"Well, that's that," Pop said. "You swung that sledge just like Paul Bunyan, Kevin. I should smile and kiss a pig if you didn't. No need to do that," he said,
now addressing Mr. Delavan, who was picking up broken chunks of plastic as prissily as a man picking up the pieces of a glass he has accidentally knocked to the floor and shattered.
"I have a boy comes in and cleans up the yard every week or two. I know it don't look like much as it is, but if I didn't have that kid, glory."
"Then maybe we ought to use your magnifying glass and take a look at those pictures," Mr. Delavan said, standing up. He dropped the few pieces of plastic he had picked up into a rusty incinerator that stood nearby and then brushed off his hands.
"Fine by me,"
Pop said. "Then burn them," Kevin reminded. "Don't forget that."
"I didn't,"
Pop said.
"I'll feel better when they're gone, too."
"Jesus," John Delavan said. He was bending over Pop Merrill's work table, looking through the lighted magnifying glass at the second-to-last photograph. It was the one in which the object around the dog's neck showed most clearly. In the last photo, the object had swung back in the other direction again.
"Kevin, look at that and tell me if it's what I think it is."
Kevin took the magnifying glass and looked. He had known, of course. But even so, it still wasn't a look just for form's sake. Clyde Tombaugh must have looked at an actual photograph of the planet Pluto for the first time with the same fascination. Tombaugh had known it was there, calculations showing similar distortions in the orbital paths of Neptune and Uranus had made Pluto not just a possibility but a necessity. Still, to know a thing was there, even to know what it was, that did not detract from the fascination of actually seeing it for the first time. He let go of the switch and handed the glass back to Pop.
"Yeah," he said to his father, "it's what you think it is."
His voice was as flat as the things in that Polaroid world, he supposed, and he felt an urge to laugh. He kept the sound inside, not because it would have been inappropriate to laugh, although he supposed it would have been, but because the sound would have come out sounding, well, flat. Pop waited, and when it became clear to him that they were going to need a nudge, he said,
"Well, don't keep me hopping from one foot to the other. What the hell is it?"
Kevin had felt reluctant to tell him before, and he felt reluctant now. There was no reason for it, but...
"Stop being so goddamn dumb. He helped you when you needed helping, no matter how he earns his dough. Tell him and burn the pictures and let's get out of here before all those clocks start striking five."
Yes, if he was around when that happened, he thought it would be the final touch. He would just go completely bananas, and they could cart him away to Juniper Hill, raving about real dogs and Polaroid worlds and cameras that took the same picture over and over again, except not quite.
"The Polaroid camera was a birthday present,"
he heard himself saying in that same dry voice.
"What it's wearing around its neck was another one."
Pop slowly pushed his glasses up onto his bald head and squinted at Kevin.
"I don't guess I'm following you, son."
"I have an aunt," Kevin said. "Actually, she's my great-aunt, but we're not supposed to call her that because she says it makes her feel old. Aunt Hilda. Anyway, Aunt Hilda's husband left her a lot of money. My mom says she's worth over $1 million, but she's a tight one."
He stopped, leaving his father space to protest. But his father only smiled sourly and nodded. Pop Merrill, who knew all about that situation... There was not, in truth, much in Castle Rock and the surrounding areas Pop didn't know at least something about. Simply held his peace and waited for the boy to get around to spilling it. "She comes and spends Christmas with us once every 3 years, and that's about the only time we'd go to church because she goes to church. We have lots of broccoli when Aunt Hilda comes. None of us like it, and it just about makes my sister puke, but Aunt Hilda likes broccoli a lot, so we have it. There was a book on our summer reading list, Great Expectations. And there was a lady in it who was just like Aunt Hilda. She got her kicks dangling her money in front of her relatives. Her name was Miss Havisham. And when Miss Havisham said fraud, people jumped. We jump, and I guess the rest of our family does, too.
Oh, your Uncle Randy makes your mother look like a piker, Mr. Delavan said unexpectedly. Kevin thought his dad meant it to sound amused in a cynical sort of way, but what came through was a deep, acidic bitterness. When Aunt Hilda says frog in Randy's house, they all just about turn cartwheels over the roof beams. Anyway, Kevin told Pop, she sends me the same thing for my birthday every year. I mean, each one is different, but each one's really the same.
What is it she sends you, boy?
A string tie, Kevin said. Like the kind you see guys wearing in old-time country music bands. It has something different on the clasp every year, but it's always a string tie. Pop snatched the magnifying glass and bent over the picture with it.
Stone the crows, he said, straightening up. A string tie. That's just what it is. How come I didn't see that?
Because it isn't the sort of thing a dog would wear around his neck, I guess, Kevin said in that same wooden voice. They had been here only 45 minutes or so, but he felt as if he had aged another 15 years. The thing to remember, his mind told him over and over, is that the camera's gone. It's nothing but splinters. Never mind all the king's horses and all the king's men. Not even all the guys who work making cameras at the Polaroid factory in Schenectady could put that baby back together again. Yes, and thank God, because this was the end of the line. As far as Kevin was concerned, if he never encountered the supernatural again until he was 80, never so much as brushed up against it, it would be too soon. Also, it's very small, Mr. Delavan pointed out. I was there when Kevin took it out of the box, and we all knew what it was going to be. The only mystery was what would be on the clasp this year. We joked about it.
What is on the clasp?
Pop asked, peering into the photograph again, or peering at it, anyway. Kevin would testify in any court in the land that peering into a Polaroid was simply impossible. A bird, Kevin said. I'm pretty sure it's a woodpecker. And that's what the dog in the picture is wearing around its neck. A string tie with a woodpecker on the clasp.
Jesus, Pop said.
He was, in his own quiet way, one of the world's finer actors. But there was no need to simulate the surprise he felt now. Mr. Delavan abruptly swept all the Polaroids together. Let's put these goddamn things in the wood stove, he said. When Kevin and his father got home, it was 5:10 and starting to drizzle. Mrs. Delavan's 2-year-old Toyota was not in the driveway. But she had been and gone. There was a note from her on the kitchen table, held down by the salt and pepper shakers. When Kevin unfolded the note, a $10 bill fell out. Dear Kevin, at the bridge game, Jane Doyen asked if Meg and I would like to have dinner with her at Bonanza, as her husband is off to Pittsburgh on business, and she's knocking around the house alone. I said we'd be delighted. Meg, especially. You know how much she likes to be one of the girls. I hope you don't mind eating in solitary splendor. Why not order a pizza and some soda for yourself, and your father can order for himself when he gets home. He doesn't like reheated pizza, and you know he'll want a couple of beers. Love you, Mom. They looked at each other, both saying, well, there's one thing we don't have to worry about, without having to say it out loud. Apparently neither she nor Meg had noticed that Mr. Delavan's car was still in the garage. Do you want me to? Kevin began, but there was no need to finish because his father cut across him. Yes, check, right now. Kevin went up the stairs by twos and into his room. He had a bureau and a desk. The bottom desk drawer was full of what Kevin simply thought of as stuff. Things it would have seemed somehow criminal to throw away, although he had no real use for any of them. There was his grandfather's pocket watch, heavy, scrolled, magnificent, and so badly rusted that the jeweler in Lewiston he and his mother had brought it to only took one look, shook his head, and pushed it back across the counter. There were 2 sets of matching cufflinks and 2 orphans, a penthouse gatefold, a paperback book called Gross Jokes, and a Sony Walkman, which had for some reason developed the habit of eating the tapes it was supposed to play. It was just stuff, that was all. There was no other word that fit. Part of the stuff, of course, was the 13 string ties Aunt Hilda had sent him for his last 13 birthdays. He took them out one by one, counted, came up with 12 instead of 13.
rooted through the stuffed drawer again, then counted again. Still 12.
Not there?
Kevin, who had been squatting, cried out and leaped to his feet.
I'm sorry, Mr. Delamont said from the doorway. That was dumb.
That's okay, Kevin said. He wondered briefly how fast a person's heart could beat before the person in question simply blew his engine.
I'm just on edge, stupid.
It's not. His father looked at him soberly. When I saw that tape, I got so scared I felt like maybe I'd have to reach into my mouth and push my stomach back down with my fingers. Kevin looked at his father gratefully. It's not there, is it? Mr. Delavan asked. The one with the woodpecker or whatever in hell it was supposed to be.
No, it's not.
Did you keep the camera in that drawer? Kevin nodded his head slowly.
Pop, Mr. Merrill said to let it rest every so often. That was part of the schedule he made out.
Something tugged briefly at his mind. Was gone.
So I stuck it in there.
Boy, Mr. Delavan said softly.
Yeah.
They looked at each other in the gloom, and then suddenly Kevin smiled. It was like watching the sunburst through a raft of clouds.
What?
I was remembering how I felt, Kevin said.
I swung that sledgehammer so hard.
Mr. Delavan began to smile, too.
I thought you were going to take off your own damn... And when it hit, it made this crunch sound. Flew every damn which way. Boom! Kevin finished. Gone!
They began to laugh together in Kevin's room, and Kevin found he was almost glad all this had happened. The sense of relief was as inexpressible and yet as perfect as the sensation one feels when, either by happy accident or by some psychic guidance, another person manages to scratch that one itchy place on one's back that one cannot scratch oneself, hitting it exactly. Bang, on the money, making it wonderfully worse for a single second by the simple touch, pressure, arrival of those fingers, and then, oh, blessed relief. It was like that with the camera, with his father's knowing.
It's gone, Kevin said.
Isn't it?
As gone as Hiroshima after the Enola Gay dropped the A-bomb on it, Mr. Delavan replied, and then added, smashed to shit is what I mean to say.
Kevin gawped at his father, and then burst into helpless peals, screams almost of laughter. His father joined him. They ordered a loaded pizza shortly after. When Mary and Meg Delavan arrived home at 7:20, they both still had the giggles.
Well, you two look like you've been up to no good, Mrs. Delavan said, a little puzzled.
There was something in their hilarity that struck the woman center of her, that deep part which the sex seems to tap into fully only in times of childbirth and disaster, as a little unhealthy. They looked and sounded like men who may have just missed having a car accident.
Want to let the ladies in on it?
Just two bachelors having a good time, Mr. Delamont said.
Smashing good time, Kevin amplified, to which his father added, is what we mean to say.
And they looked at each other and were howling again. Meg, honestly bewildered, looked at her mother and said,
why are they doing that, Mom?
Mrs. Delavan said,
because they have penises, dear. Go hang up your coat.
Bob Merrill let the Delavans, pair a feast, out and then locked the door behind them. He turned off all the lights, save for the one over the work table, produced his keys, and opened his own stuffed drawer. From it, he took Kevin Delavan's Polaroid Sun 660, chipped, but otherwise undamaged, and looked at it fixedly. It had scared both the father and the son. That was clear enough to Pop. It had scared him as well, and still did. But to put a thing like this on a block and smash it to smithereens? That was crazy. There was a way to turn a buck on this goddamn thing. There always was. Pop locked it away in the drawer. He would sleep on it, and by the morning he would know how to proceed. In truth, he already had a pretty goddamn good idea. He got up, snapped off the work light, and wove his way through the gloom toward the steps leading up to his apartment. He moved with the unthinking, sure-footed grace of long practice. Halfway there, he stopped. He felt an urge, an amazingly strong urge, to go back and look at the camera again. What in God's name for? He didn't even have any film for the Christless thing. Not that he had any intentions of taking any pictures with it. If someone else wanted to take snapshots, watch that dog's progress, the buyer was welcome. Caveat emperor, as he always said. Let the goddamn emperor caveat or not as it suited him. As for him, he'd as soon go into a cage filled with lions without even a goddamn whip and chair. Still, leave it, he said roughly in the darkness. And the sound of his own voice startled him and got him moving. And he went upstairs without another look back.